Hartley, a mammoth construction of evil. Its very size frightened him. That, and the knowledge that evil men could construct such an infernal machine. Straining his eyes, he thought he could see the brown bulk of Mexico and the barren gray desert of the southwestern United States. Yes, and farther north, beneath a swirl of clouds, lay Florida, and beyond that, Washington, the capital of the great Satan, where their president will make his last speech later this day. Washington, D.C. Senator Thornton rode with Senator Quill to Arlington National Cemetery. The Memorial Day service at the Tomb of the Unknowns was an annual observance, a chance for the president to use the emotions of patriotism and sacrifice to further his own political agenda. The president was fighting for his political life, Jane knew. The latest polls showed that Morgan Scanwell was within 12 percentage points of the president, and the national conventions hadn't even convened yet. Quill wore a lightweight gray suit with a carefully knotted lavender tie and a jeweled American flag pin in his lapel. Sitting beside him in the rear seat of the limousine, Jane was in a conservative coral pink knee-length sheath. Both senators would accept red poppies from an amputee veteran in a wheelchair when they got out of the limousine. The photo opportunity had been set up by Quill's publicity aides. "Where's Morgan this fine morning?" Quill asked cheerfully.
"In Austin. He's meeting with the delegation chairman this morning, and then there's a big barbecue later this afternoon."
"He wasn't invited to Arlington?" Quill teased.
"The president's going to invite the candidate who will oppose him in November. Be real, Bob."
"Morgan doesn't have the candidacy sewn up yet. Jackson's close enough to make a real fight at the convention, especially if he picks Roswell as his running mate." Jane scoffed at the thought.
"Liz Roswell would lose more votes than she gains."
Quill pursed his lips thoughtfully. "You might be right."
"I know Morgan's got a lot of work ahead of him," Jane said more seriously. "But he's going into the convention as the leading candidate, and we're going to go for a first ballot win."
"Jackson won't accept the number two slot."
"Our people are talking to his people.
He won't go for it." Jane let a knowing little smile curve her lips.
"Then maybe I will."
"You?" Quill's mouth hung open. Laughing, Jane said, "That's the first time I've ever seen you really surprised, Bob. You're not serious."
"We've talked about it," Jane said lightly.
"Pillow talk."
Her smile disappeared. "It's more than that. We might have a big announcement to make just before the convention opens."
His composure recovered. Quill leaned back in the limousine's plush seat and chuckled quietly. "Let me guess."
"Go right ahead."
"You're going to get married."
Jane smiled again but said nothing. In her mind, though, she wondered how Dan would react to the announcement.
"Stop that," she commanded herself. "Put Dan out of your mind. You're heading for the White House. That's the important thing. The nation needs Morgan, and nothing's going to stop us from making him president, not Dan or anything else."
By the time the limousine pulled to a stop in front of the waiting Marine Corps veteran in his wheelchair, Jane had almost succeeded in forgetting about Dan.
Standing at the base of the launch pad, Dan looked over his maintenance crew with a jaundiced eye. "By damn, you guys look like something the cat dragged in." Jerry Adair grinned wryly. "It was your party, boss." "Start sucking oxygen," Dan snapped. "You've got to be ready to launch as soon as the space plane's fueled up." One of the technicians stared at him.
"We're going up?
Now?
Today?"
"Damned right," said Dan.
"But it's the holiday."
"You'll get double pay."
Shaking his head, the technician said,
"It's not that. We got a picnic planned. My wife's family came down from Nebraska, for Christ's sake."
"We've got an emergency on our hands," Dan said.
"My wife's gonna kill me."
Looking at the dark clouds piling up over the Gulf, Dan thought, "If Mother Nature doesn't kill you first." The director of the FBI's Houston branch did not appreciate having to come into the office on Memorial Day, especially when she'd been there the day before.
"What's all this hysteria about?"
she snapped as she stormed into her office. She was wearing a loose sweater over a T-shirt and cut-off jeans that exposed her skinny, knobby-kneed legs.
Kelly Emmons was already there, pacing nervously. April Simmons isn't at her apartment.
So? It's a holiday, for God's sake. Most people spend holidays with their families.
The director's acid-dripping irony made no impression on Emmons. You don't understand. She said she wasn't going to France with al-Bashir, but now I can't find her.
Use the tracking beacon.
I tried. The guys downstairs claimed they can't find her signal. The director slammed down into her desk chair, muttering, This was a screwball operation from the beginning.
She's out of range of our local equipment, Kelly said, pacing again. I thought you said she'd decided not to go to France with the suspect.
She did, yesterday afternoon. But now...
Agent Chavez barged into the office, looking distressed. He was wearing shorts, too, picnic clothes.
I got your message, he said to Emmons. The guys downstairs still can't pick up her signal.
She's gone with him after all, Emmons muttered.
But you said she'd decided not to, said the director.
Something changed her mind.
Or somebody, Chavez chimed in.
She could be in trouble.
The director shook her head, glaring at them both. Then she reached for her telephone.
Do you two loose cannons have any idea of the levels of hierarchy I'm going to have to go through to get the satellite spooks to see if they can pick up her signal?
Emmons brightened.
She must be in a plane, heading for France.
Or already there, said Chavez. In Marseille.
Sit down, the director said, pecking at her quick-dial keyboard.
This could take hours.
Geosynchronous orbit. Gilly Williamson had killed people before. The first time was when a daft policeman barged in on him in the cellar of the safe house where he was wiring a car bomb. Before he could even think about it, Williamson put 4 9-millimeter bullets through the fool's chest. He expected to feel guilty about it. He expected it would give him nightmares. But it didn't. It was him or me, he knew. The damned idiot hesitated, and I didn't. That's the difference between life and death. Of course, the bombs he devised killed dozens, perhaps hundreds. He had never kept score. But personal killing face to face, that was a different matter. There was the informer that was going to rat out the whole cell to the Tommies. He was stupid enough to warn Gilly over pints at a pub in London. Gilly had thanked him from the bottom of his heart, and then, after they walked together to the bastard's car parked back in the alley, Gilly had brained him with the fool's own electric torch. He'd looked so surprised when the first blow cracked his skull open. In a few seconds you couldn't recognize his face at all. That was when Gilly had to leave the United Kingdom, leave his wife and kids, and travel to blasted North Africa, Casablanca. Nothing like the movie, he found. Then Oran, another cesspit full of gabbling Arabs. In Tunis, he was recruited by the Nine, although he never met any of the mucky mucks, just their flunkies. He knew he had cancer. He'd known it since he'd been diagnosed by the public health doctors back in London. Cigarettes, they claimed. Bad genes, bad luck. What difference? He knew he was going to die, and the only question was, how could he provide for his wife and kids? This one-way mission to the satellite was his answer. Williamson had mailed the bank receipt to his wife before he'd gone off to the remote training base in the stark granite gray mountains of northern China. Now he hung suspended on a tether halfway between the enormous satellite and the transfer craft where Nikolaev waited for them to finish their tasks. Below him glowed the blue and white flecked earth. Beyond it he could see a crescent moon, small and slim like the symbol on Arab flags. There were stars out there, too. But Williamson could only see a few of the brightest through the dark tinting of his helmet visor, and he paid no attention to them. He had finished his wiring task nearly half an hour ago. The satellite was no longer beaming power through its antenna. Once they removed the antenna and attached the new special one they'd carried up with them, their job would be finished. Then it would be up to the crew on the ground to point that antenna where they wanted it. But before that could happen, Williamson had one additional task to do. Nikolaev. The Russian was a mercenary, a professional cosmonaut who'd been paid to carry these two men to the power satellite. He didn't know what they were doing to the power sat, and he didn't care. He expected to wait for them to finish their work, whatever it was,
and then fly them back to a landing in Kazakhstan.